Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lenise Ambelotti from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Ulrike Krauss about her book, Difficult Life in a Refugee Camp, Gender, Violence, and Coping in Uganda, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. Ulrike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. So I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. Yes. I'm junior professor of forced migration and refugee studies at Osnabrück University, and my research broadly revolves around the nexus of conflict, displacement, and peace, gender and gender-based violence, how it's connected in the different phases of displacements, the global refugee regime and humanitarian system, including policies, norms, and practices, and of course also agency of refugees and their resilience. Regionally, I focus on global developments as well as those in Africa. And doing that research, of course, I also think much about knowledge production and research ethics and how we actually carry out research and believe to create something that we define as knowledge.
Thank you. So let's begin with how this book came about. How did you come to write this book, Difficult Life in a Refugee Camp?
This is actually my second book. It's part of my postdoc project. The project is entitled Gender Relations in Confined Spaces, Conditions, Scope, and Forms of Sexual Violence Against Women in Refugee Camps, which was led by Professor Susanne Bakker-Tistel at the Center for Conflict Studies at Marburg University. The project, at its core, had women as potential victims of violence at the heart, basically. And we wanted to see why the violence takes place, how often or to what extent, as well as in which forms. And that created several puzzles for me. First of all, the title itself is already critical because women as victims has a tendency of victimizing only women and even unconsciously or indirectly framing men as perpetrators, potentially even natural perpetrators. And this is an issue because we know from the research that gender-based violence can, of course, also affect men. Yet at the time of research, and this is one great gap in the book as well, at the time of research, the government of Uganda, where we carried out research, enacted the anti-homosexuality bill. Rape against men was often and still is often interpreted as a homosexual act. And so I could not ensure that potential male rape victims would be safe. So we had to withdraw from a strategic approach to our research with men. And that also applies to LGBTQIA people. So the first puzzle really is still about gender-based violence, not limited to women, but focused on women. The second puzzle in the project, as well as in the book, is how does that relate to violence to conflict? Violence in refugee camps are not limited to camps, but in what ways is it connected to the time before? The third puzzle that came up also was core in the project, but became even stronger in the course of the research, is gender relations. In research, there are a number of studies which mention that gender relations change. But how? Why? To what extent? This is something that that I focused on in the research. And finally, the fourth puzzle that I was extremely interested in from not only a research perspective, but also a personal one, is how do people cope with the massive violence, with the restrictions, with the uncertainties on so many different levels? How do people deal with it and essentially practice their agency?
So I'm looking forward to kind of picking apart the book. But do you mind providing listeners with some contextual information about refugees in Uganda in general and the particular camp that you focus on in this book?
Yes, thank you. Uganda, for those who have not been to Uganda or don't know the map too well, Uganda is a relatively small country in East Africa, neighboring the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, Kenya, as well as in the southwest, Burundi and Rwanda, and of course in the south, the Victoria Lake. Uganda has a long history of displacement within the country, as well as people seeking asylum and safety there. And at the moment, it is one of the countries that with the largest refugee population. About 1.5 million refugees are in this small country. But already at the time when Uganda became independent from the colonial power of the UK, people were fleeing to the country and seeking safety there. And ever since then, Uganda used a camp system that is actually entitled settlements. So we have a number of camps that are actually called refugee, Rhino Camp Settlement. And that settlement idea is strongly connected to the political approach that the government of Uganda takes. It also has a longer historical tradition dating back to colonial times. But since independence, it was strongly related to a development orientation. Humanitarian refugee protection is from the start a humanitarian, hence an emergency approach. It's about providing, registering people, providing food and non-food items, medical care, and so on, but not an approach that is sustainable and long-term. And Uganda connected it from early on, and that's where this idea of settlement comes in. Refugees receive access to a plot of land for agriculture to grow their own food. And so the settlements are quite big. For example, Chakatu Refugee Settlement, as it's called, where I carried out research, is about 84 square kilometers large, and that is a relatively small camp in Uganda. It was established for about 17,000 refugees, but at the time of research, more than 20,000, far more than 20,000 people lived there. And at the moment, about 120,000 people live there. I could go on and on about the development orientation, which I'm not going to do. I actually explored that in my PhD. I do not use the word settlement in my book because I think it is misleading. Despite the settlement term gives the idea that refugees choose to live there are among their peers, but they're really forced, even by law in Uganda, to live in these designated spaces. It is a strongly hierarchical place that is run by humanitarian agencies and not by the people. They don't have a choice or much of a choice, and they're strongly limited by the local restrictions. And so I continue to use the word camp instead of settlement in the book.
Thank you for that. So before we get into the empirics, I wanted to ask you how you went about doing the research for this book. What types of data collection did you engage in?
For the research, we used a qualitative, mainly qualitative, multi-method approach. And I'm saying we because I had the great privilege to work with Christine Nimusema and Pearl Karuhanja, who both are from Uganda, as well as 12 refugees as peer researchers. Christine is a clinical psychologist and Pearl is a political scientist with a focus on gender and the refugees with whom I also worked with were either enrolled in university's degrees or had already finished them, mainly focusing on social work. So that fit very well. And together or through that teamwork in Uganda, we were able to reconceptualize and adjust some of the research approaches and research questions that we already identified prior to traveling, or prior to traveling to Uganda and collecting the data. So the work, the cooperation was extremely valuable for the research. In detail, we used a number of different methods to not purely collect responses or to collect information, but really to get insights into the experience, the lived experiences of the people, how they understand, conceptualize issues, and how they practice their agency. With refugees, we used 65 so-called Arabic dialogues. These are a form of unstructured interviews, but really actually conversations like you and I are doing at the moment. We don't have a list of prepared concrete questions that we ask, but really have the conversation go and also give the people the opportunity to raise questions they find important that may not be central to the research project but are key to them. Among these 65 people, there were 42 women and 23 men. Most of them, in general, most of the people that we spoke with were from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In addition to that, we used 7 focus group discussions with 35 participants, 16 of them were women, 19 were men. Here, I ended up really focusing on what was said, although, of course, focus group discussions give us the opportunity to also explore power dynamics in groups. However, we look at a multicultural and multinational context in Uganda, although I have, or in Chakatu especially, and while I have lived 3 years in Uganda in the past, prior to the research, it would more be a creative interpretation of what was going on in the discussion than proper research. So I focused on what was discussed and what the key messages were. To also explore positions of young people, we use journal writings as a way of asking open questions in a child-sensitive approach, so they could respond to as much as they wanted to or as little as they wanted to and not respond to any questions. We worked with 37 people here. They were between 15 and 19 years, and 18 were young women and 19 young men. We also carried out 2 surveys with an overall of 751 people. One was focused on gender-based violence and one on the overall condition and aid structures in the camp. We used anonymous written multiple choice questions here. 53% were women and 47 were men. Finally, although the focus was, of course, on the people who reside in the camp, I can't explore a camp without also working with the humanitarian and political actors, hence the aid actors there. And to interview them, we use structured and semi-structured interviews. All of the employees of aid agencies were Ugandan, 14 were women and 14 were men. Doing that research in the refugee camp went hand in hand with ethical issues as well as questions. I'm a white Western trained researcher who for this particular project went to Uganda for 3 months to collect data. I just mentioned, yes, I lived in the country for 3 years and worked with refugees in the past, but this does not say that I know everything or can do everything right. So in the team, also with my former supervisor, Susanna, we thought much about how we can design the research in a way that is most ethical, but also tackle the strong hierarchies and power dynamics that are involved in our research. So one thing that led our research and also guided our ideas about how we can actually carry out the research is, how can we do no harm? Do no harm is mentioned so often in so many publications as the golden rule, but that was simply not enough for us, because a golden rule can be broken without anyone being taken to justice. And what we did is carrying out a do no harm analysis prior to, during, as well as after the research, following a concept by Anderson, which was from the 90s. She conceptualized it actually for development projects to avoid conflictive situations and to promote connecting situations, basically. During the research, we carried out the Do No Harm analysis as a team with Christine and Pearl, as well as the 12 refugees, which was extremely helpful to better understand the local conditions. In addition, another question that that worked our minds a lot is, how can we ensure informed consent and voluntary participation? People who do not work in research, how can I explain what I do with the data, how I work with the data, what it means to analyze data, what data actually is? So here to use a sensitive approach to informed consent and voluntary participation, we drew on the relational approach that McKenzie et al. Outlined in their, I think it was 2007, article about ethical relations. And that helped us a lot to continuously discuss informed consent rather than once getting the signature on a standardized paper. There are a whole lot more ethical questions that guided our research, but I'll stop here and only mention that ethical questions are still at the core for me, also when I wrote the book. What terms do I use? How do I approach people? How do I frame my role in the research as well as in the team? How do I speak about the people's experiences? Do I use the term refugee? Do I use the term victim? And so on and so forth. This is something that continues to work my mind in publications that I'm working on now in the book. And I think we need much more discussion about ethical approaches to knowledge production than we have, especially in political science.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I genuinely appreciated the extended discussion of ethical considerations that you have up front in the book, which is not something that we often see in many refugee studies works, but which perhaps we should be seeing more of, right? So diving into the empirics, you begin with a description of gender-based violence in the camp. You make an argument that patterns of violence that we see during encampment are linked with violence during the conflict in refugees' home country, and also linked with violence during the journeys that refugees made to escape it. Can I ask you to talk a little bit about this? You call it a continuum of violence at one point in the book.
Exactly. Thank you so much. So as I mentioned, the project started out with sexual violence against women in refugee camps. And while we linked conflict and displacement from the start of the project, it was really not the connection of these different phases, let me call it. But the more I spoke with people, the more often they connected the violence they experienced in the camp with the ones that they experienced during conflict, how such experiences of violence contributed to their displacement, how they continued to experience different forms of gender-based violence during their flight, during the process of their flight, after reaching the camp, and so on and so forth. So it became a big, here I use the word puzzle again, but really a puzzle. And putting these pieces together showed that although in peace and conflict studies we know that leaving conflict does not mean an end of violence, here is the evidence how violence continues and is connected with each other through different, very specific factors. So we see, or how I framed it, is a continuum of violence, which is not merely a continuation of violence, but really a connection of the violence, the gender-based violence that takes place in the conflict, during flight, as well as in the camp. In the camp, the most prevalent forms of violence were sexual violence in a way of rape, also defilement of younger people, and threats of rape, then structural violence and cultural violence of denial of resources, denial, whether be it agricultural resources or access to education, but also militarized forms of violence, which especially affected men. So, and here's the point of not only women being potential victims of violence, but also men. The main perpetrators of such violence in the camp were actually acquaintances. These could be husbands, so intimate partner violence, fathers or other acquaintances, like people from the neighborhood. During flight and conflict, these victim-perpetrator structures changed slightly. Also, the forms changed slightly, but it was still connected. During conflict, the main form of violence that occurred were sexual violence, and that was particularly perpetrated by members of conflict parties. And that violence was mainly perpetrated to spread fear. It was hence mainly women as victims and men as perpetrators. However, men were also confronted with forced recruitment to conflict parties because they were men. Also, women were confronted with being forcibly recruited as bush wives, but that was rarely spoken about by the people. During flight, these main forms of violence, of sexual violence and forced recruitment, continued during flight. But here it was not only the conflict parties who committed the violence, but also other fleeing people, especially sexual violence. The connecting parts here in this big puzzle is, first of all, lack of law enforcement. The violence can only take place because there is a pure lack of law enforcement, even in the camp. I spoke with a number of people who mentioned that they had seen perpetrators who perpetrated the violence during conflict or during displacement in the camp, and authorities insufficiently reacted to it. The second area is gender dynamics and gender power imbalances in a way of who is supposed to have this say and who's supposed to be subordinate, and what kind of violence can take place and can be done. So there are a number of different areas that bring these different forms of violence together. In the past, I spoke about a tendency to privatization of violence in the camp, because it moves from public spaces for violence to be seen in conflicts to private spaces in camps. And I think it is important to go beyond the focus on one side, on either conflict or displacement, in order to see how these different phenomena are linked.
Now, you're very much interested in the role of humanitarian agencies here, and you show that humanitarian agencies work to respond to gender-based violence, but that their efforts may in some ways also contribute to that violence. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Yes, thank you. The chapter about humanitarian aid puzzled me for quite a while, because there were so many issues that I didn't quite know where to start, honestly. So I focused on three different aspects in the chapter. The first one is really a general approach to how decision-making structures and power structures take place. The second one is about responding to gender-based violence. And this is the questions you are going to. I think we need to look at the broader area too in order to understand the second one. People are generally, displaced people, refugees are generally treated as protection objects and not really have a say in how the camps are run, how aid is provided, how policies are implemented. It is changing at the moment. We do see a lot of developments, but at the time of research, they were merely the beneficiaries, the target groups, the objects. And that becomes even clearer when we look at gender-based violence, how aid agencies respond to it. They have a focus on women, protecting women, but entirely disregard men, and by that influence gender relations. And on the one hand, not only prevent violence, but also contribute to violence. So through the way of them trying to protect women, they unconsciously and certainly unintendedly contribute to the prevalence of violence that we see in so many spaces and places. The second way in which the camp condition contributes to violence is really the camp condition itself. It's such a large space with insufficient law enforcement. There was one police officer and one agency for 20,000 people in the camp that was located in the base camp and in the other 84 square kilometers, there was no one. Receiving access to support when you were further away from the base camp was very difficult. So the entire landscape of the camp contributed to the continuation and the prevalence of violence. Let's, for instance, look at the example of younger children going to schools. If they have a long walk to school, they have a long walk that is unprotected to the school. Thirdly, there are, of course, also examples in which aid workers actually perpetrated violence, misused their power, misused pressure, especially towards younger women and girls, to engage in sexual favors to receive aid. These issues were carefully spoken about by refugees, but a problem they continue to mention is, where should they go? Even if they went to report it, aren't they friends, the people who perpetrated the violence, aren't they potentially friends with those who received the reports? So this is a great issue that we heard about in the past, also in the news, happening elsewhere, happening in other humanitarian crises, but especially in these refugee camps that exist for decades and decades, like Chaka. Chaka 2 was established in 1984. I believe I forgot to mention that earlier. And I spoke with people who lived a lifetime in a camp. Two men fled the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1965 and 1968. This is a lifetime in a camp, a lifetime governed by humanitarian agencies. And if they don't find protection, of course, it continues to be a difficult life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, one of the things that I want to mention for listeners is that, and it may not come across as clearly sort of in the conversation that we're having right now, is that in the book, you are very careful to use the exact words that refugees themselves used in describing their conditions to you. And that, I think, makes many of these patterns that you're describing even more sort of vivid and even more heart-wrenching, to be honest. So, you know, building on sort of the a theme that you've mentioned now a couple of times, the theme of sort of gender roles. Based on your research, what changes did you observe in gender roles and relations in the camp?
Thank you. Generally speaking, on a very, very basic level, the gender roles and relations that I found in the camp were patriarchal, in a way of men being believed to be decision makers and the powerful actors, as opposed to women and younger people who are supposed to follow men's role. In order to further explore that, I drew on Hearn's approach to the hegemony of men. And while the hegemony of man may seem to be, from the title of the concept of the theory, an approach that focuses solely on man, this is not the case. Hearn conceptualizes it in a way of how different social actors, especially men, but others too, understand the roles as well as practice them through social practices, and how this is intertwined in a gender system. And to understand, especially also the changes, I had to look into how conditions were, or how the people I worked with and I spoke with experiences and memorized or remembered the situation prior to flight. I'm going to focus on the situation in the camp now, though. In the camp, there was a lot of discussion about men being the leaders. However, men hardly being able to fulfill these roles because of the restrictions, because of the limitations, because of the lack of livelihoods, because of the uncertainties for the future, because they couldn't provide for their families as they would hope for, as they also worked for. And part of these issues are because of the humanitarian restrictions and the humanitarian aid that is provided to them. However, actually not, however, women partly as well as strongly agreed with it. Strongly agreed with the insufficient livelihoods, and partly because of the lack that men could contribute to the families. A great and very interesting part in the data was how women described their roles when it was entirely disconnected to gender roles and gender relations. Well, with regard to gender relations, they also described women as the ones who have to listen to men, have to follow men's role. But once it is beyond gender relations, they described the numerous various roles they had and they fulfilled, how they worked, gained independence through economic practices, fought for having a voice, involved themselves in decision-making structures, also democratic-like structures in the camp with different voting, had were or became representatives of several groups, and so on. And that was extremely interesting how this tension arose and how they explained it. Another very interesting part is speaking with youth or younger people about gender relations. While they've described their gender relations among each other as entirely equal, with regard to adults, they describe the hierarchies of men being the leader and women having to submit to men's leadership. The third very interesting part here is the role of aid workers. While aid workers try to promote gender equality also through the humanitarian projects, they figuratively became part of gender relations due to the power they had to make decisions in the camp, to provide support or not provide support, to decide who receives access to certain projects and who doesn't. So while trying to promote gender equality, they are part of the gender relations, although they may not want to or may not even be aware how much they're part of it. And thirdly, while they themselves strongly believing in patriarchal conditions and them believing that the man should make the decisions. One example here is on World Women's Day. I was in Chakatu, and aid agencies carried out a conference for women to not only celebrate women, but to also further their education. And the title was Change Begins at Home. And interestingly, one part of this conference was to educating women how they have to satisfy their husbands also sexually. And I was intrigued and frustrated on so many different levels of what an interesting tension arises here of trying to promote gender equality, being part of gender relations, and at the same time maintaining these structures. So yeah, a big puzzle.
Just remarkable. Yeah. So the final piece of the empirical puzzle is about coping strategies.
Yeah.
So what strategies did refugees use to cope with these various circumstances that you've described?
The chapter about coping strategies, in the chapter about coping strategies, I wanted to not only reflect on the big strategies and the big practices people use or that I may define as such, but really the everyday practices, starting with conflict and displacement itself. Oftentimes when even people in research, but also journalists, media, politicians speak about conflict and displacement, it almost sounds like a passive reflex in a way of, hey, there's violence, people automatically flee. But this is not the case. Flight is a conscious decision, one that people might take early on to protect their families. This was a case, especially the case for younger, not for younger people, but for people with younger children, that they, if they were still together, as soon as the violence came closer, they decided to move and leave the site. While others, especially young men who feared forced recruitment to conflict parties, they fled, they decided to flee by themselves without even letting their families know in order to protect their families and in order to protect themselves. So in this chapter, I started off with these discussions about a gender-sensitive perspective of displacement and people's decisions to flee and also not to flee, to wait. For example, a number of women shared experience of their husbands being taken or their fathers being taken by conflict parties, and they waited as long as they somehow could, trying to protect their children from the conflict, practicing to hide or having to hide if soldiers came. So the level of violence was tremendous, but it's still an active decision that the people take in order to weigh up when to flee or not to flee. And I think we need to keep that in mind. generally, in order to explore coping and practicing agency, I drew on Lister's approach to agency, which is a feminist approach, which she conceptualized focusing on poverty. She outlines four ways through which we see how people practice agency, and that is getting by, getting out, getting organized, and getting back at. And these are practices I also found in how people cope with the difficult conditions in the camp. And here I'm not only speaking about violence as such, but also the limited livelihoods, access to education, access to or uncertain future, access to aid, and so on and so forth. And I found not only individual practices, but especially also collective practices through which people cope with experiences in a way of speaking together, but also silence, when to be silent, when to speak out, were consciously taken decisions to protect themselves, but also to move on, to handle experiences. In the camp, the people used a variety of economic practices, whether being developed, whether working on the field and doing agriculture, developing small businesses, basically even developing an economic hub. And in research, there is a very interesting yet extremely critical hype about entrepreneurship of refugees. And this is what I discuss critically in this chapter too. Entrepreneurship, refugees are described as entrepreneurs, and how creatively they cope with the restrictions and the difficulties and basically having nothing. And I find that discussion extremely limited and extremely problematic, because sexual violence and prostitution, sex for favor, would that be part of these entrepreneurships? Or entrepreneurial practices? I don't think so. But this is part of what people have to do to get on. And although very difficult, yes, I do think they also practice agency through these strategies. We just need to be careful of how things are phrased and what we see, what we discuss, and what we don't discuss. And a way of getting out as well as getting by is legal conscious. People claiming their rights, but also sometimes hiding certain aspects. Being very aware of their rights and maneuvering the difficulties by, for instance, hiding their nationality, and but consciously hiding their nationality and representing themselves as a different nationality. That their a third area is hope, and not only in a religious way, but also hope for a future. Hope was portrayed as both a coping strategy, as such, as well as a vehicle for other coping strategies. For people to be able to move on, to stay hopeful, to handle what I frame in the book as multidimensional uncertainties for the future, for how to deal with the current restrictions, not knowing when they may have to return to a place of origin, which we may describe as home in research, but really is not home if they've never lived there and been born in a camp. So hope was central. And in German, we have a saying that hope moves mountains. I'm not sure if it makes sense in English, but this is really what the narratives reflected, showing how important their hope was for a better future, but also their religious hope, practicing this hope together and believing that something better will come, perhaps not even for them, but for their children. But that hope was extremely powerful.
Thank you for that. Now, towards the end of the book, you reflect on the theme of time and space, which is a theme that's kind of woven throughout the entire book. Can I ask you to speak on that a little bit?
Thank you. Yes. Time was an issue that runs through all chapters. And after I finished the first draft of the book, I thought of multiple ways and approaches through which I can theorize time and have it more actively run through the book, but I couldn't, because in each chapter I discussed time from different perspectives. For instance, in the chapter about violence during conflict, flight, and encampment, it is really an approach to different phases and also times of experiencing violence for people, and theoretically connecting conflict and displacement, and here conflict studies and forced migration studies. In the second chapter about humanitarian, or here the third one, about humanitarian aid and the camp landscape, it's really about protracted refugee situation and the powerful positions of humanitarian agencies over such a long time, and how this concept of protractedness is used in a way of, as I mentioned early on, having a development-oriented approach to refugee protection, not only humanitarian aid. Then the third one, looking at gender relations, how gender relations change. And here I especially also discuss how people remember situations and gender relations at home. And that concept of remembering is yet a different approach to time. And thirdly, in the last chapter, I look at the future and the multidimensional uncertainties. And well, I believe time is an extremely important category. I was unable to have it captured in this one category to look at it and have it really run through the whole book. And I do hope to see more research on time in the future. There have recently been several papers on it and a couple of books, and I hope that, yeah, it receives much more attention.
Well, Ulrike, we've taken up a lot of your time. So just one final question. This book has been out for a little while now. So what are you working on now?
Thank you for asking. I am currently working, as so many of us, on many projects, but there are three main projects that I'm working on at the moment. First of all, I am finishing another book on refugees as humanitarian actors. This is only the working title, this is definitely going to change, but at the core is a project that I led and carried out together with Hannah Schmidt and also Joshua Gatto in Uganda too, about refugee-led organizations and their role, what issues they face, how they're created. And we look at both rather loose forms of organization, self-organization, as well as highly formalized and institutionalized ones. And we hope to finish it in the next couple of months. So we're quite far here. Then the second area of research that I'm exploring in my team too, together with Nadine Degatlo and Hannah Edler, is the role of peace. There's so much research about conflict and displacement, not necessarily in connection, but in some ways also in connection. But the role of peace is so disregarded and has received so little attention. And this project focuses on how, with the case study of Kakuma in Kenya, how people understand peace beyond the Eurocentric approach, and also how they contribute to peace in Kakuma as well as transnationally. And the third project is something that I've published in a couple of papers recently, is post-colonial approaches to understanding forced migration studies as well as refugee law and protection. We have a very Western approach, despite Chimney's paper of geopolitics and refugee protection, which was published more than 20 years ago, there's still a very Western approach to how research is carried out. And I'm fortunate to work with wonderful colleagues here to better understand what role colonialism plays here, and also what role disregarding it plays, how non-Western people have in the past and are still othered in a way of not receiving the same protection as white people, which we just now, a couple of years, or for the past year, we've seen with how Ukrainian people are treated in Europe as opposed to people fleeing Afghanistan, Syria, or let alone people from African countries, which is deserves much more attention.
Those all sound like fantastic projects. I've appreciated some of your previous work on the role of the colonial origins of the refugee regime. And your new book sounds fantastic. I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it on the podcast.
I would love to. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very, very much for having me again, and I hope you have a nice evening.
The book is Ulrike Krause's Difficult Life in a Refugee Camp, Gender, Violence, and Coping in Uganda, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. Thank you for listening.